So my name is Gonzalo Martinez de Bedia. My age is 33. Today is Friday, June 11th, 2021. I am in Sao Paulo, Brazil, with Dr. Kathy Sexsmith. And I've known Kathy for over 10 years now, probably, in a few capacities, but above all as a friend.
Thanks. I am Kathy Sexsmith. I'm 36 years old, and I'm currently in State College, Pennsylvania, here with my good and longstanding friend and someone I admire, Gonzalo. So I kind of wanted to tell you, Gonzalo, about, you know, some of the first memories I have of you. So like when we first interacted at Cornell about 10 years ago, I was the grad student and you were the undergrad. And I always kind of felt like you knew about a million times more than I did about all of the topics we were working on farm worker issues. And I always kind of remember feeling like some of these like funny situations where, you know, I would be doing something with a group of friends and Gonzalo would say, "Hey, Kathy, we have to go out to this farm because there's someone who really needs help. Do you want to come?" I'd be like, "Oh, but I'm with my friends, but let's do it because Gonzalo, you're so committed to this and I want you to see my commitment too." And I would go with you on these sometimes pretty wild road trips around rural New York to have my eyes open to this world that you've really kind of made central to who you are.
What I remember is there are really only three roads to get you out of Ithaca, right? And two of them, I know there's more, but the main ones really that got us out to the farms, two of them were just up that really steep part of town where you had to kind of weave your way up the side of a lake somewhere. Yeah. And then, you know, whatever anyone signed up to go that far out of town, I knew they were gonna be in it for the long haul, you know, with stuff. That in itself was a journey, right?
That's true. So I passed the test, eh?
You know, I thought of it the other way around. That I had, I'm the oldest of five, you know? So one time, my little brother, when he was younger, was realizing that because I was older than him, you know, 5 years older, every time he would, you know, have a birthday, he would catch up to me a little bit, but then I'd just be another step ahead next time. You know, he was young enough, he was still trying to figure out this concept of people all aging sort of at the same time. Mm-hmm. And he got really mad at me that he would catch me, you know? So that's how I think of our friendship and that, and our work, that no matter what I do, you're already a step ahead, you know? I got into the farm worker topic. You were already getting your PhD. I spent my time abroad. You'd already done that in Mexico by the time I got out there. So as much as it's been a friendship, in a way, you've been a mentor as well.
That's nice. I appreciate that. It's a mutual feeling. So I wanted, like, you know, we've talked about this lots over the years, but like for you, it all, or this could be wrong, but my impression is that your work in the trafficking world kind of all began in Ithaca with the Cornell Farmworker Program. And I wanted to ask you, what happened in Ithaca that compelled you to commit to this for the basically rest of your adult life? Like, what pulled you into this world from that period in your life?
Yeah, in the beginning, it was more of a circumstance that there just happened to be this program, this person in particular, Mary Jo Dudley, who's running the Cornell Farmworker Program, I think going through another cycle of recruiting students who might have availability and the right language skills to get out and do some of the program's work. And I didn't think too much of it in the beginning. It was just another activity, really. I think I actually caught up to it my freshman year, so it really was from the start. But what Mary Jo let me sort of start to learn about in the upstate New York area, it had a huge impact on how I ended up orienting myself and in what I was studying, and ultimately what I did for work. I got to peek out of our little bubble, you know, and get to know the experiences of other immigrants. You and I could probably talk about our own immigration experiences in the U.S. And what would be 100% certain about that is that they're extremely different from the average experience of a low-wage worker who arrives in the United States, sometimes through a guest worker visa or without documentation. Over the years, some of what I learned started to feel like, you know, to really cause anger that I was building my life in this country where I'd been welcomed in so many ways and really had a lot to be grateful for. Often, really, if you think about Ithaca and the environment we were in, celebrated for being an immigrant, for having the background that I did, for bringing the perspectives that I did, and that the same country could also have an avenue for immigrants where they were primarily only valued for the work that they could, their labor, really, and that in every other way that they could engage in society or have a broader, put down some roots or have some civic engagement, they were systemically blocked from that. You know, you could argue, you know, by design, there's an entire avenue of immigration where people are not encouraged to integrate, to have a voice in political systems. And the more clear that became to me, the more I found it to be outrageous. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought about my family. I thought about the different people in my family and what they like to do in the world, their work. And I started to wonder, you know, if some of them were in the United States, would they be put into that avenue because they were in a certain profession or had a certain, you know, path. So I started to look around more to the activist community at that time, mm-hmm. not just within the farm worker world, but more broadly in the worker rights and immigrant rights world. And you wouldn't remember from that time, there was a lot there in Ithaca in particular. So that's where I found a place to start to think about the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm. So how, I mean, we should give context, right? So I came to do my PhD in the US from Canada on a student visa. And, you know, obviously you moved as a child, you totally uprooted yourself and moved to the US. And I was wondering, you know, we've talked about this a little bit over the years, but like, how do you think your identity as Argentine shapes the way you do your work and also the way that the trafficking victims you work with interact with you?
Yeah, I think what's funny is at the start, some programs sort of, including, you know, university programs and such, they try to kind of put everyone into categories. And I've always been in that very umbrella Latinx, you know, side of how people count up their, you know, students or employees or whatever it might be. But of course, as so many people know, and some people are more aware of than others, there's such a diversity within that world. And specifically, as an Argentine, there's usually not too many of us anywhere in the US. You can, I've come across, you know, fellow Buenos Aires people all over the world, but you don't get to the level of having, you know, like a lively Argentine Student Association or something like that. Some other countries have had that for many reasons, right? But, you know, in the beginning, I felt the pressure to erase that a little bit, because I could assume, or I did used to assume, that programs would hire me because I could speak Spanish and, you know, small talk about soccer with workers, and that that would make me a better outreach worker, and that would make me connect with people better. And a part of that is true, but, you know, workers aren't expecting an Argentine to come knock it on their door at any given day. And when I speak in my real sort of the accent that I grew up with, that if I use the words that we really use in Buenos Aires, it's foreign. It's a different kind of foreign to someone from Veracruz or Oaxaca, right? It's not American foreign, but it's still, you know, Argentine foreign. And in the beginning, this is something that it took me years to really get through, but I would try to ease my accent to sort of hide it and speak in the way maybe people talk on CNN Español, you know, just kind of like the generic, could be from anywhere Spanish. And I realized that I was doing that just not to stand out, not to distract, you know. But that in the end, it was not giving people an opportunity to make up their own mind about what it meant to chat with an Argentine. You know, people have different experiences with different people from all over the world, and, you know, soccer actually is a big bridge. So if any people know anything about Argentina, it's going to be about Messi, or, you know, Mexico plays Argentina in the World Cup and that kind of thing. And when I kind of let myself be just more transparent about that, and that, you know, I'm not from Mexico, I'm not from Central America, but that I still had, you know, a conversation to have, it worked a lot better. You know, people would just sort of take it for what it was. Over the years, you know, I've had the luck of being able to go to Mexico to get to know different parts of where people are coming from to work on farms in the U.S. So I have more of a context, and I have more of an ability to kind of, you know, talk about what is going on in Mexico and understand some of the slang. But I've never gone back to wanting to hide that, you know, that I'm from a very far-flung part of the world.
I have to say, like, because my Spanish is, you know, obviously pretty gringo Spanish, but it's very influenced by Mexico because of my family ties. And lots of times you use words that I'm like, is my Spanish awful? Do I just, like, not know what he's saying because of the slang? And I've never told you that before, but sometimes I'm, like, really embarrassed to talk Spanish around you because I'm like, geez, he has a lot of slang that I've never heard.
Yeah, the perennial Argentine experience is like inside jokes that no one understands outside of Buenos Aires. Just having, you know, it just happens. I'm in Brazil now, and even there, it's just such a gulf. Like, just going between Buenos Aires and Sao Paulo, it's a 2-hour flight. Mm-hmm. Culturally, and obviously, you know, different language, it just, the references aren't there. So, you know, I just have to make my annual trip home to really be fully in my world.
Your pilgrimage.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wanted to talk maybe a little bit, like, more specifically about the work that you do. So how do most people, you know, the general public, conceptualize of a trafficking victim? And how does the population that you work with differ from that kind of mainstream set of assumptions?
Yeah, the trafficking topic, as it's defined, you know, we're at the 20 years of the TVPA right now. That was a very encompassing definition of different forms of exploitation. The common theme is force, fraud, and coercion, but it applies to people who are exploited through those means in a very wide set of sort of higher risk sectors. And really, you know, these things happen in any context, but when we talk about the cases that end up in the court system, we're really dealing with one big category of cases sending that involve commercial sex in some way. And then situations that come up in domestic work, farms, restaurants, hospitality, really most low wage jobs that employ migrant or immigrant labor. have been at the top of the list for many years. And of course, cases that involve both sexual exploitation and human and labor trafficking. So I would say, I think it's fair to say most people who find their way into that bigger tent of what we could call the anti-trafficking field in the United States arrive there through experience or interest in the commercial sex side of the puzzle and things that are happening there. There are agencies with very long histories of focusing on labor issues within the trafficking field, but they are, in my mind, in my experience, the minority. I wasn't there for all 20 years of the history of the TVPA or how the field has developed, but as I understand it, we've come a long way in terms of really, making sure that funding and resources that go into human trafficking generally actually go towards the full spectrum of trafficking and don't just fixate on one form. But you can only do so much to account for that at a design level or a funding level. What also ends up mattering are people's hearts and minds and the individuals who work within law enforcement, who work within service agencies, and what they bring to the work. Many people are given that umbrella job of, serving all trafficking victims, or prosecutors, a liaison in a federal prosecutor's office might have that trafficking hat. And many of them do end up sort of orienting towards the commercial sex side of the equation. And I have many ideas for why that happens, but it does mean that those of us who have focused more on, for example, the agricultural sector, where there is plenty of this going on, we always have that uphill battle in terms of getting people to really stop and think about how they should be approaching this work differently when they look at farms and what's going on there.
So why is that? Like, why is it so hard to get sufficient empathy from, law enforcement officials and the public for labor trafficking victims, particularly in agriculture? Like, why, if it's such a pervasive problem, why is this overlooked?
There's been great research specifically looking at some factors. People have been primed with different trafficking scenarios. In one of them, for example, it might be an American-born teenager who is being exploited for commercial sex. And in another case, it might be an undocumented adult male from Mexico who is being exploited for their labor. And you could measure the sympathy gap between those scenarios. So unfortunately, there's just simply that. It's the victim profile. It's who is involved. The perpetrator profiles matter quite a bit as well. But even taking a step back from the individuals involved, I think about the systems within which these scenarios take place, right? In one of these scenarios, you have, let's imagine, a scenario of the commercial sexual exploitation of children online. There really isn't a lobby that's ever going to stand up for any of that, right? It is a truly bipartisan issue, and it's one that, when it comes to especially teenagers, youth, people feel extremely motivated to put all their resources into solving it, as they should, right? It's a worthy project and a full-time job for many people to look at that really difficult picture and see what they can do. However, when you get into recurring forced labor cases in agricultural supply chains, there's another constellation of interests that are at play, where you have purchasers putting produce from these situations on shelves for consumers to buy, where you have politicians who, public servants, right, who have to mostly be accountable to landowning U.S. citizen rural voters, and not as much to migrant workers who will never be able to vote in that rural election, right? Mm-hmm. So would anyone come out and say that they are in favor of forced labor? Never, right? Never. But there are 100 shades of gray in between the two sides, let's call it, where people begin to hedge and say, well, you know, let's not increase liability here. You know, these farmers don't really know what's going on. What if there is a bad middleman and you know, something happens and then, you know, someone gets in trouble who shouldn't, right? There's a lot more hedging that happens, unfortunately. And that's at a policy level. That's when we talk about, you know, increasing penalties and that kind of thing. But going back to that hearts and minds idea, put yourself in the shoes of the local elected sheriff in a rural county anywhere in the U.S., right? Who elected you? You know, who is the tax base in your county? If you go to certain parts of the country, the meatpacking plant might be the only game in town economically, right? So they not only create the jobs that are available, they also are paying the salaries to the people that are paying rent in all the properties. In some way, they're just the beating heart of that economy. So are you as an elected local official eager to run into that workplace and start rocking the boat? In the best case scenario, you might hear someone who's truly committed to that mission say, it shouldn't matter. If there are victims of crime, I want to meet them. I want to, you know, get them the resources they need. The reality in my experience is another. It's that people find themselves in really difficult conflicts of interest where they'd rather go after, you know, sex trafficking cases on the internet than have to knock down the door of the local migrant worker housing for so many reasons, right? Mm-hmm.
So now that we're kind of starting to go down a darker road, I was wondering if there are any cases that haunt you, any people you've come across or situations that you want to share?
Yeah, I mean, what's hard is so many of these agencies I was just mentioning, service providers, law enforcement, the task forces generally, we have the ability to come and go. We can drive to a location, get to know people, sometimes for years. We can get on the news, we can go to court, we can accompany people, but ultimately we retain our ability to leave, to move on to another project, as I have many times to move states, to move countries. Many of the people that I've worked with who are living through these experiences are uniquely not able to do that, meaning they have found their way, let's say, to a potato farm in Texas, and that was their big break, meaning they won the lottery. They got that H-2A agricultural guest worker visa, and they were able to get that through a relative who introduced them to someone who charged them $5,000 for a job, right? And they know that their ability to stay on that list of people who will be invited back to the farm is an economic lifeline for them and their families. They've hedged their financial futures on that happening. And you know, when push comes to shove and some people start blowing the whistle on abusive managers, on abusive employers, things get into the news, things get into the court system. A lot of these delicate situations get shaken up. And what that specifically can mean for a worker is they get informally blacklisted. They do sometimes lose their ability to make that paycheck every 2 weeks. And I don't think, as much as we talk about it in the trafficking field, I don't think we think about that enough. About people who end up dislodged from their place in the labor, you know, world. You do get people who end up back in their source community as a direct consequence of stepping up and reporting a situation. And in not in all of those scenarios is the trafficking field actually able to connect with that person and get them another job or bring them back to the US. Sometimes, yes. You know, those are the good stories where I hear about someone getting a T visa and being able to build a life outside of that exploitation network. But for every one of those stories, in my experience, there are two or three others of people who just have to pay a price. And it's quite a sacrifice people make. And I think about it when I remember different people that I've met over the years.
Well, that's such a fascinating answer, because I was thinking more a little bit about like individual cases, like things you've seen that are deeply disturbing. I know there's a lot of it, but you're basically saying that sometimes you feel haunted by how your advocacy work ends up getting people sent back to Mexico.
Well, yeah, because I think that's where agencies where I've worked and my colleagues, that's where we have the most work to do. There are situations in the world that feel like they're just baked into the risk profile of the economy, meaning you go into the domestic work world, you go into the garment sector, you go into agriculture, there will always be that minority of managers and employers that choose to use fraud and coercion and force against their work. Yeah. You know, as part of a much broader spectrum of exploitation, which is endemic, right?
Yeah.
But you could argue, you know, these are systemic issues that really involve a lot of different stakeholders that each have a big responsibility. And primarily, it's private companies and the purchasers of goods that have a lot of work to do in the garment and farm sectors, for example. So we constantly work to remedy those situations. But I think on our way to do that, service agencies and law enforcement have so much work to do to make sure that we're not adding damage to that equation. And there are so many examples of places where, unfortunately, damage has been done on agencies' way to help, if you know what I mean. So that is what I think about the most. Yeah, it's definitely not the most extreme case of things that I've seen out there, but it's the one where I feel like I've, you know, the most to do.
So now maybe thinking a bit more optimistically, when was a time, like what stands out in your mind as a time when you were really successful, when you made a positive impact?
You know, it depends on how you look at impact. I've worked with enough M&E teams that I, you know, I've learned different ways to count these things and pile them up. So I think there's a more, you know, quantifiable, when I think about working with systems, specifically doing policy work, sometimes the impact is great if you were able to change an entire system or put a new mechanism in place for an entire supply chain. Let's say you've built a grievance mechanism that's going to affect hundreds of thousands of workers and actually provide access to remedies for sexual harassment and exploitation, health and safety issues on a job. In my mind, you know, that's what many smart people are working on and focus on for good reason, right? That's where the scale is. But in my heart of hearts, it's the individual cases that I think about or that where I felt the most direct connection to a change. There was a situation in one town in New York that I won't name that I got very involved in, to the degree that I just ended up meeting many of the people on the exploitation side of the picture and knowing many people who were affected by a sex and labor trafficking situation. And as it goes with these situations, it's a never-ending string of developments for individual people. And I've specifically had the privilege of walking through the justice system and the service provision system with just a couple of people in that town over now many, many years. And one of them who had started, unfortunately, fell into that picture when he was still very young, is now finally seeing some results out of all of the time he took to talk with law enforcement to link up with the legal aid. He earned a T visa, which is such a rare in the grand scheme of things. You know, you look at the U visa for victims of crime, a much more mainstream remedy for people of all, you know, who have all kinds of experiences. But the T visa, it's sort of, every one of them is hard won, I think, by a lot of really hardworking agencies. And in this case in particular, I'd been advised that it was a long shot for many reasons for him. So I think everyone just gave it their best effort. And I had my small part in it. And we found out just a little while ago that the government finally made a decision on that. And he will have an ability to regularize his immigration status in the US, possibly move to another part of the country, get into another profession, and not have to run into his traffickers. It's been a journey, you know, many, many years on that one. And over that time, I've just had a lot of chances to chat with him on the phone or meet in person when there really wasn't anything to talk about, where there weren't developments, where we didn't have any guarantee of where things were headed. But I felt like I had more of that support role of just hearing it out and learning about what was going wrong through him. I'm so happy for him that he got that positive outcome. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what the next 10 years bring for him, right? As he kind of gets to move away from that situation.
I mean, you've really covered the whole, maybe one thing that I've always sort of admired about how you do your work is that you literally work at every imaginable level. So the individual relationship building and providing the emotional support to people who need it. I know you've done that with lots of folks over the years. And then like sitting in Chuck Schumer's office and saying, you need to do XYZ thing to protect the rights of victims. But that's like what's so impressive about your career, you know, that you're not even that far into. I mean, you're not even 35. And like, think of all the levels of power and the individual lives that you've, you know, engaged with and positively impacted.
Yeah, the trafficking field is very diverse, and it's, you know, the number of different disciplines that kind of cross through from policy to more of a traditional grassroots worker rights approach to the legal aid and all the foundations that are looking for even other ways to help investigative journalism that's being funded in the space. I've been lucky to have many people kind of let me into their world. Social workers, for example, or trained psychiatrists, you know, you name it. I mean, people who are really specialized in their field have let me sort of sit in and listen and see what they bring to the table. One consequence of that is that the trafficking field does allow for some people like me to end up floating between those spaces without becoming too specialized in any one of them, right? So I am not an attorney. I'm not law enforcement. But I feel like I've, through so many years, been able to just listen to the individual needs of those spaces. And I can summarize sort of their general take on certain issues. And at a policy level, I've been able to advocate for changes that people within each of those disciplines have looked for in the space. So that's always been interesting, but I always also have felt like a guest in many spaces, including in the DC policy world.
Mm-hmm. Like thinking, like you just talked about social workers and people you admire, who are some of the individuals who have influenced you and created like a positive example that you try to follow?
The people that I've looked up to the most when I think about where I'm headed or where I'd like to be in the next round, you know, in the next 10 years, 20 years, are the ones who do the heavy lifting of actually designing and then getting programs funded, then looking after just the basic steps that have to happen to keep those programs healthy and operating. I think about all the talented people that come out of programs like the one where you teach, that are ready to do something in the world. There's such an interest, and you would know this better than me as a professor, that so many students are looking for meaningful work, more than just going into the private sector. But there is a mismatch between that demand and the supply of jobs, full-time jobs, that'll pay off somebody's student debt, for example, and still have, right, a meaningful side to them. The private sector is always open for business, always hiring. You know, if you want to go into that more traditional approach, if you want to work for companies in the HR department or become a farm labor contractor, you know, it's a hot economy. There's a lot out there, especially for people who have specialized training. So what do we have to do on the nonprofit side, on the government side, to really open not just jobs, but career paths for people, that so that we get the top talent, you know, people who are going to make more of an impact than I would be able to, for example. I think about Lou Papenfuss at the Worker Justice Center. You know, there's someone who, he didn't get his name in the news as much. He really kept his head down and just kept trains running on time. Of course, you know, the day-to-day of nonprofits is always a little bit of chaos, right? So I'm sure people could come up with stories of things, you know, getting turned in late or not going the right way. But I always remember the rare few times that I've, you know, rolled out of bed before I had to and maybe had something to work on in the office, that I'd get up there to Culver, to where the office is in Rochester, on a winter day, and he before people were in the office, he had a shovel in his hand, and he'd be shoveling the driveway, right, getting the driveway in this office ready for the staff to come in and park their cars and get to work. He never asked anyone else to come in. There weren't interns given the task, you know, as you might see in some places. He's the executive director. He had to look after grants. He had to maintain relationships with everyone on the board, stuff like that. And I think he still found the time to do that basic sort of background work that has to happen. And I came to really admire that over the years when I had a chance to work for him and everyone else over there at the Worker Justice Center. That's my idea of leadership. That's what I look up to. Mm-hmm.
My husband has a book called Los Líderes Comen al Final. You think about that. Uh-huh. So maybe to wrap it up, what advice would your, I could say 33 because you already said it, but 33-year-old Gonzalo give to, you know, young Gonzalo who graduated from Cornell about 10 or 11 years ago as he was starting out his career?
Let me try to think back to what I was thinking back then. You know, when I look back at 10 years of wearing different hats, half of the time I was thrown into it, meaning someone went on parental leave and needed someone to go, you know, facilitate a task force or be with a worker. Like in that town that I mentioned, for example, where I ended up being so involved, I never felt prepared. For the biggest opportunities that I've had, I objectively just was undertrained. And there were people out there in the broader field that were in, you know, more qualified to do what I was doing. Some of that was related to age, some of it, sometimes to training, right? To having the right background to do a specific task. And for a while, that was always at the front of my mind, that I, you know, people talk about the imposter syndrome and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I've realized over time that the need in the space is so great, and the people that have been funded to be able to do this work, the few privileged programs that have had the opportunity to actually hire teams to get out to the field are so few, that's always going to be there. It's inevitable. No matter how much we scale, you always will have a new round of people coming into it who could have had better training, who could have been more prepared, who could have sat through more webinars on what they were about to do and just haven't yet. And I would have, I think, if I could have given myself advice, just let myself off the hook a little bit more about that. You know, knowing when to ask for help, knowing when to stop and check in with the expert, of course, matters. But as I think about the new people that are going to come out to the farms to start to learn about forced labor, to think about supply chains, I'd advise them not to be too worried about being new. We could take 10 times the people we have right now, and we'd still need more. So get rid of that.
Kind of like a believe in yourself kind of message.
Yeah, I always pretended I did, right? Like when I get to Albany and chair a task force when I was 20, you know, 23, 24 years old, I'd put on the best tie that I had and facilitate the meeting. But I think people would laugh in Albany, like people that I've now known for a few years, some of them who are doing these interviews, they would laugh if they knew what I was feeling like in the morning on my driving. I remember driving on I-87 to these meetings and just feeling the adrenaline, feeling like I just wasn't, you know, I couldn't possibly be the person to try to facilitate a meeting between federal law enforcement and social workers and policymakers. And over time, I got over that fear. And I've had to, right, over and over again. But yeah, there's always going to be a little bit of that, I think, for everyone along the way, right?
Yeah. Maybe that brings us, it's a good place to end. It brings us right back where we started when I was a grad student and I was up in the North Country of New York doing research. And here you come and you say, hey, Kathy, I pulled together a meeting of over 20 federal law enforcement. I think you even had like the FBI there, all of these like public service providers. And you were like 24 years old. I'll never forget that. I was blown away at how you not only brought all those people to the table, but facilitated a meaningful conversation about trafficking with them. I mean, that was something that really has stuck with me.
Yeah, and they've stuck with me. I've made some friends from that time that I, you know, they're probably doing these interviews right now and talking about how one time a 24-year-old was chairing their meeting and it was embarrassing for them. But in the end, we're all moving in the same direction. So I think that's what matters. I was always glad to have you there, Kathy. Somewhere in the, you were never specifically in the trafficking lane, but you were in the broader universe of farm worker rights. And whenever I needed that extra perspective, you were there. And I think, you know, that's part of the advice maybe is people should have a friend and a mentor to kind of let them take a step back and think about the bigger picture. Yeah. Thank you for being that for me.
My pleasure. It's been one of the most meaningful friendships I've had, for sure. All right.